Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. A motorcycle carrying a suicide bomber tore through a crowded marketplace in the northwestern province of Afghanistan on Wednesday, killing at least 25 people and wounding dozens. The attack is one of a number of deadly bombings throughout the country over the past several weeks. The Taliban has taken credit for them in an intensifying war as U.S. troops ostensibly prepare to withdraw. The violence is ramping up despite talks that were held at the beginning of the month between the Taliban and the Afghan government under President Ashraf Ghani, who is a major U.S. ally. Not only are Afghans being subjected to Taliban violence, but the U.S. has also increased the number of its bombing campaigns. An airstrike by U.S. helicopters on Monday killed 7 soldiers of the Afghan National Army. Joining me now is Kathy Kelly. She is the co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. She recently returned from Afghanistan in June. Welcome to Uprising, Kathy.
Hello, Sonali. Thank you for your invitation to be on the show.
Thanks so much for joining us. So what is behind the increase in Taliban violence as far as you can tell? It seems as though every other day now there's a suicide bombing. Is this part of the normal, in quotes, summer offensive?
Well, Sonali, you mentioned the July 7th meetings that happened between Ashraf Ghani's government and representatives of the Taliban, beginning to suggest that there could be negotiations. And some analysts are saying that the Taliban want to have leverage in those talks. They want to be persuasive about the territory that they control. So maybe that has something to do with an increase in attacks. By hearsay, when I'm in Afghanistan, people say that the roadways leading to Kabul are largely controlled by various militias, many of them Taliban. And that some have the impression that maybe the Taliban doesn't want the headache of trying to control a major city like Kabul, but that in the rural areas, people living in areas that are not protected by government forces feel very, very vulnerable to many different kinds of militias.
Now, the U.S.-led coalition forces, and really mostly the U.S., we should say, had ramped down its bombing, but ramped it up again in recent weeks. How deeply was the how much of a strain to U.S.-Afghan relations has the bombing on Monday that I mentioned earlier had? This was the bombing that from helicopter where the U.S. essentially inadvertently killed 7 Afghan National Army soldiers.
Well, certainly people are likely to wonder, well, how is the government going to protect us as civilians when the group that the government signed a bilateral security agreement with is bombing our own military? I should imagine this has created tremendous disaster, and it's hard to know what is in the mind of the generals who order these kinds of attacks. You know, there's no ceasefire that's been declared on the part of the Afghan government, and the United States certainly doesn't seem to be earnest about trying to promote a ceasefire. But in fact, in the first 4 months of this year, 1,000 civilians have been killed in the fighting. So that's, of course, a rise. And then that has the, I don't know, maybe it's a spillover effect, but horrid effect of people fleeing from violence, becoming displaced. If they're farmers, they don't plant their crops. If they are shepherds, they don't bring their flocks with them when they flee. And so there's been a terrible rise in hunger, hunger amongst children, over 550,000 children at risk of severe acute malnourishment, suffering from severe acute malnourishment, 719,000 people in prolonged displacement. So it's not only the fighting that kills people, but actually hunger and disease and displacement as well.
And I want to talk about that ongoing poverty, which, of course, long predates the Taliban's arrival and about which very little has happened under U.S. occupation. But just staying on the issue of the Afghan National Army for a bit, the New York Times had a report on Wednesday called Afghan Security Forces Struggle Just to Maintain Stalemate. This is the force that the U.S. government, when it eventually, if it eventually withdraws, will hand over power to. But their morale is low. There have been a lot of desertions. because many are maiming themselves reportedly so they don't have to serve. And of course, some of them are being killed by the U.S. directly, accidentally, apparently, as happened on Monday. Is this the army that Afghans have to protect them from violence?
Well, and then actually the situation can be described as even more threatening to civilians, because the warlords who have, under Karzai and now again under Ashraf Ghani, been incorporated into the government, these are fearsome warlords who've committed war crimes. I'm thinking of General Dostum, who's the vice president of Afghanistan. He actually went to a neighboring province of the Faryab province. When you mentioned the suicide bombing, he has now gone there and said, well, I'll take charge. I can summon up vast numbers of people who are loyal to me, who will become armed militias, and we'll move in and take charge. So people are, in a sense, caught, I suppose, the proverbial between the pillar and the post, with nowhere to run, nowhere to hide when violence starts up. And of course, they don't want to leave their children sitting there as targets. And so they run, and they go to squalid, overcrowded refugee camps. This, of course, contributes to the huge problems with child laborers being the only ones who can earn an income. It's a very terribly violent situation. And when we think about the United States having been there with this massive presence, $104 billion was spent in non-military aid in Afghanistan. What has it created? What has been accomplished? And I want to press that question, because why would we ever think that continued United States military attacks would improve the situation or not contribute toward the development of even more extremist, fundamentalist armed groups in places like Afghanistan?
And of course, we are seeing that all over the nearby Middle East, where the U.S. military presence essentially just triggers more chaos and more violence. This is a pattern that is being observed in Iraq and in Syria and in Yemen. Let's also talk about, you brought up Abdul-Rashid Dostum, which I'm really glad you did. And, you know, shockingly, he is the vice president of Afghanistan. Shocking, because he was such a brutal warlord with so much blood, Afghan blood, on his hands. He is now working outside, as you mentioned, the government's regular security establishment to fight the Taliban in the north. This was the situation that the U.S. came into when, before the September 11th attacks and before the U.S. invasion in October of 2001, the forces of the Northern Alliance, where Abdul-Rashid Dostum was one of the commanders, were fighting the Taliban. They were called the Northern Alliance because the northern part of the country was the only part of the country they had control over, and the Taliban had controlled large parts of the south. I mean, 13 years, 14 years later, almost nothing has changed, except more people are dead.
And you could also mention the change in as much as now the Taliban has more control, or some very well-armed militant groups, many of which appear to be Taliban, have more control in the east and increasingly now in the north. So yes, the question, what has changed, is a frustrating and a debilitating question for many, many people in Afghanistan. And then, of course, we should also add that technology has changed in as much as now people also fear the drones in the skies up above. You had mentioned Syria, and I think it's very troubling that Ashton Carter, when he...
Defense Secretary.
I'm sorry, yeah, Defense Secretary Ashton Carter recently said that with regard to Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the self-styled head of the Islamic State as the caliph, when he said, if we had a chance to take him out, we would. He didn't say if we were certain that we wouldn't kill any civilians in the area, if we were certain that no children would be killed, then we would take action, but rather that we would take him out. Well, so many times these drones have apparently pinpointed some level of leadership, some person that they think is the proverbial bad guy, and they kill civilians. And I want to mention again, this lowers the possibility of a ceasefire, which it would seem to me has to be the beginning of any kind of meaningful negotiations.
Yeah, and the U.S. is absolutely dropping drones in Afghanistan as well as traditional airstrikes. Now, on the issue of poverty in Afghanistan and the U.S. occupation, while the poverty levels in Afghanistan, which were among the highest in the world, rivaling only perhaps sub-Saharan Africa, that poverty has predated the U.S. presence. Almost nothing has changed, short of some schools going up, many of which have then been burnt down. And perhaps in cities like Kabul, where there has been a sort of NGOization, as some people call it, with non-profit, non-governmental organizations raising property values and living in fortified compounds outside of Kabul, very little has changed on the ground. You mentioned the very high numbers of children living in poverty. In the meantime, the U.S., of course, is pouring money into its military operations. And ProPublica, which is this investigative journalist outfit, here in the U.S., did an investigation revealing that the U.S. was building these massive warehouses from which for U.S. troops, which are now going unused because the U.S., I guess, is still in the process of deciding whether it's going to have ground troops or not. And according to this one report, a warehouse complex in Kandahar will be turned over to the Afghan government with air conditioning and fire suppression systems that are too sophisticated for them to use. These warehouses have cost U.S. taxpayers tens of millions of dollars. Meanwhile, Afghan children, as you pointed out, Kathy, are starving. I mean, I'd love your comments on this.
Well, it's certainly not an isolated incident. Another shocking incident of continued construction of an unusable facility was when a hospital was constructed in the Ghazni province, in Gardez, and there would never be enough fuel to power this very state-of-the-art hospitals. But once the contracts are made, once the subcontracting is done, then people say, well, it's a good photo op for donors, and our groups will continue to get money to pay for people who maybe do or don't do often very shoddy construction on many of these projects. BuzzFlash recently gave a very thorough report, but it was also one that had been initiated by the Special Inspector General in Afghanistan report, John Sopko, about the ways in which about $746 million, which has been designated for construction of schools and payment of teachers, apparently can't be accounted for. And there are many instances of ghost schools, schools that don't exist, ghost students, students that aren't in the schools, ghost teachers, teachers that aren't actually teaching. And, you know, I think of the kids I see when I'm over in Afghanistan. I get a chance to be with the Afghan peace volunteers who could see so clearly in their own neighborhoods, children working in long and often very precarious conditions, long hours, bad conditions. These are street children who are part of often either refugee camps or the sons and daughters of widows who are forced up the mountainsides and have no heat, no fuel, no water. And so for some income, the kids are out there on the streets. There are 6 million child laborers, 60,000 of them in Kabul alone. And so in the major cities. And so my young friends have opened up a school where they do remedial courses in Dari and in math. And they've actually in 7 months got quite a good number of their 80 students. They've got 30 who have gained literacy. And you can trust that. You can see it. You know that these university students are volunteering their time, and you see the children so eager to learn. But part of the success has meant giving every family a sack of rice and a container of oil so that they won't starve because they're so dependent on the children to bring in the income. Now, what kind of a progress is this? And yet the United States dares to say that we've made things better for women and children in Afghanistan. That's a marketing ploy to sell warfare.
Well, speaking of a marketing ploy, one of the things that has come out about out of Afghanistan regarding the violence that children face is that the government is attempting to ban toy guns in Afghanistan because of injury. I'm guessing these are like BB guns that are that essentially can end up harming children, hundreds of children who were injured by toy guns that they buy with, you know, the small amount of money that they might get during Eid. What do you make of this? They're trying to curb the culture of violence in Afghanistan by banning toy guns.
Well, of course, one would wish that there could be a ban on the importation of the real lethal guns. And, you know, I think Anand Gopal's book, No Good Men Among the Living, is extremely helpful in pointing out that if you want to trace the development of one of the armed militias, and there are many that then get into cycles of violence and revenge and exploitation, trace the development of a United States military base, because that's the initial importation, quite often, of funds and guns. And once one group manages to make some kind of an arrangement with people at a base, give us guns, give us funds, we'll be part of your protection, or we'll be, then they can turn that into a protection racket and even sometimes attack the base so that their own position as the defenders will continue. It's a pernicious development. But certainly, when you go to visit the museum that shows in Kabul just case after case of the shells, the landmines, the different kinds of weapons that have been used all across Afghanistan, and the many, many countries that have profited from this. You can't only, I mean, we shouldn't only point to Afghans as warlords who have made tremendous profit off of presence in Afghanistan.
Kathy Kelly, there has been talk of ISIS in Afghanistan, and you mentioned that earlier. Even though geographically Iran lies right in between Iraq and Syria and where Afghanistan is, it wouldn't be surprising at all for ISIS to emerge in Afghanistan and ally itself with the Taliban, who are fellow Sunni Muslims. How active, as far as you know, is ISIS in Afghanistan?
Well, I think that's a very, very difficult question. Some have said to us when we're over in Afghanistan that people who have grievances, who are perhaps undereducated, don't have jobs, are willing to join whatever group they think is going to be the strongest. And so there would be competition between the Taliban and these various groupings that identify with the Islamic State. But maybe one comment that might be helpful on my part is to say that the United States has unleashed so much violence in the region, dating back to, I would say, certainly the 1991 invasion and attacks against Iraq, and certainly the arming of the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. I don't think the United States any longer can control what happens as a result of violence that was begun by the United States. It's not right to say that it's all because of internecine battles or sectarian battles. The United States should acknowledge what we've done and pay reparations. But I don't think the United States can any longer control who gets the upper hand or where borders might be drawn. What we could do is uphold the idea of a ceasefire by saying, so we're not going to fire one more drone, we're not going to unleash one more Hellfire missile, we're going to look for alternatives to destruction and bloodshed. Enough blood has been shed in that region.
And of course, Kathy, there is speculation that ISIS's presence in Afghanistan could give the U.S. more reason to remain in Afghanistan. There has been an agreement for the U.S. to begin withdrawing. It's not clear whether the U.S. will withdraw, will stay. And now with the ramping up of bombing by the U.S. and also the ramping up of drone strikes, there was a significant ramping up of drone strikes, that some of which were actually aimed at ISIS. How likely is it, you think, or is there a real fear that ISIS's presence in Afghanistan will give the U.S. impetus to remain there indefinitely?
Well, I think that hawks within the United States Congress and Senate are likely to pressure for that. I think that the United States think tanks that are charged with marketing wars will keep on appealing to the humanitarian notions that somehow we have a responsibility to protect. But it's perhaps a little bit like the many-headed Hydra. When the United States uses drones or helicopters to attack one grouping, they have never been able to say, and therefore we've now achieved success. I think that many new groups spring up, and the possibility that the United States is eyeing China and saying we don't want China to be able to stabilize the violence in Afghanistan so that China could then begin to use routes that would allow for extraction of resources that might exist under the Hindu Kush Mountains, or routes that would enable China to move fuels and energy resources through Afghanistan. It could be that the United States does not want to see stability in Afghanistan. But at any rate, when you look at the amount of money that we've budgeted to go toward ongoing United States militarism in Afghanistan, it certainly doesn't seem as though the United States is interested in a ceasefire.
I mean, and this is really sad. What you're talking about, of course, sounds like yet another great game being played in Afghanistan, that term having historic significance because of Afghanistan's geopolitical position in the heart of Central Asia, you know, in the backyard of Russia and China, in a place that the U.S. now has these military bases that, even if it does withdraw, will continue to be a standing threat to Russia and China. And if China's involvement and Afghan stability, if Afghan stability is seen as facilitating Chinese involvement, and therefore we shouldn't have a stable Afghanistan, the people who are suffering are, or of course, ordinary Afghans. And I want to ask you in the last few minutes of our conversation to tell our audience the work that you do with Voices for Creative Nonviolence. You mentioned the Afghan Peace Volunteers, and you travel there regularly. We don't hear enough about what ordinary Afghans are doing, are saying, and what they want. And I can't imagine, after decades and decades, you know, of children who are people who are in their 30s have only known war from the time of their birth, and what they're doing and how they're managing.
Well, certainly the trauma is severe. I don't really know anybody in Afghanistan who doesn't suffer from severe trauma related either to displacement or malnutrition as children, experiences of nearly freezing to death, losing loved ones, being bereaved, and then being anxious. I mean, there were many explosions during my recent visit, and certainly after I left. And so people that we know have been remarkable to me in their desire to stretch out their hands and help people who are even needier than themselves. This is, to me, what gives a great deal of inspiration to continue trying to learn from the Afghan Peace Volunteers and others, because I think they just can't turn their heads away, even though you face the reality of not being able to come anywhere close to helping the sheer numbers of people that are hungry, the numbers of women who can't feed their children. I see my young friends saying, okay, we're going to do the Duvet Project. We're going to invite 20 Hazara, 20 Tajik, 20 Pashto women to make these duvets, and we'll distribute them free of charge. And they spend their free time going out like social workers to the refugee camps and to the very, very impoverished villages, just to make sure that the duvets, oh, these are heavy blankets that are wool stuff blankets that can make the difference between life and death during the cold winter. And then they go to the families of the children that they've invited to come and be part of this right now 80-person strong street kids school moving toward 100 students. And they get to know those families and they build relationships. So I think that this is the kind of thing that builds peace, when people are much more interested in extending a hand of real friendship than in trying to see if they can't equip themselves with weapons and align themselves with warlords.
And what you're describing is how people are essentially trying to survive on their own in spite of the violence. And, you know, nothing that the U.S. has done in the last 13, 14 years has facilitated this, short of removing the Taliban from Kabul. So maybe within Kabul, there are people who might enjoy a little bit of relative freedom. But outside of that, the efforts you're describing is what people are doing in order to survive, and they will continue to do that without any real help from other governments, you know, with a little bit of solidarity from individuals in the West like yourself. But, you know, it's just incredible to see that that survival continues and that people do manage. I'm wondering, Kathy, what you think lies in the future for Afghanistan with these talks, going back to what we started discussing, that there were talks between the Taliban and the Afghan government, which, you know, on the one hand, such talks end up putting power back into the hands of the war makers. But if the war makers make peace between themselves, at least the guns might stop firing. How far do you think those talks are going to go if the U.S. is, you know, ramping up its bombing?
Well, you've certainly identified a major prevention of further talks. It is true that the Taliban had formerly said, we're not going to talk at all as long as any troops are in Afghanistan. And now the troops are in Afghanistan and they have begun to talk. I guess maybe the thing that we must keep an eye on is that 70% of Afghanistan's population live in the rural areas. They don't live in the relatively better off area of Kabul or larger cities. And so it's those people who are at risk of starvation, who often are forced to flee, who would like to plant crops or, you know, shepherd their flocks or cultivate orchards. And Afghanistan is a rural, agricultural country. And it's that kind of an economy which I think in the best of all circumstances would be rebuilt, respectful of what the hard work people are willing to do in order to survive.
Kathy, I want to thank you so much for spending this time with us and shedding light on a topic that isn't getting enough attention. Thanks so much for all the work you do as well.
Thank you, Sonali.
My guest is Kathy Kelly. She's the co-coordinator of the group Voices for Creative Nonviolence. She recently returned from Afghanistan in June.